episode 444 of the Autoblog Podcast. I'm joined this week by Chris Bruce and George Kennedy of BoldRide.com, and we talk about Monterey Car Week, the 2016 Toyota Tacoma, and this week's news bites. That's all ahead on episode 444 of the Autoblog Podcast. Welcome to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Dan Roth. I'm joined this week by Chris Bruce.
Good evening, everyone.
And George Kennedy.
Howdy.
George Kennedy of BoldRide.com, everybody.
That's right.
late of Autoblog and Consumer Reports. So George is making the rounds. You know what? we'll be courteous. And what car in the Bugsy fleet are you driving this week?
I'm just rocking my personal Jeep right now. It's late in the summer, so, you know, kayaking and mountain biking and, you know, my 99 Cherokee with the aftermarket bumper just sort of does its whole thing. And
you're just getting some XJ love?
I am getting all sorts of XJ love, and it's starting to show its age, and it's manifesting itself in all sorts of weird ways. It's deciding not to turn on sometimes. Deciding to cut out the highway. I mean, Jeeps are notorious for, you know, older Jeeps are notorious for sort of electronic gremlins. And this one may have been a, like, hurricane car when I bought it to begin with. So that's what I had to work with years ago.
And
so
you get to, like, look for the rust on the seat frames. Like, should not be there.
It's been really good from a rust standpoint, believe it or not. It's been just a lot of electronic gremlins.
Excellent. Have you been doing anything this summer? Did you go to go to any of the events and drive any of the fancy cars?
Nothing yet. Just sort of, you know, like we were saying, doing the management thing. So, you know, running the show at Bold Ride. So everybody else gets to do all the fun stuff while I sort of, you know, say go forth and drive.
So what's on your list then that you need to drive? Maybe we've driven it and we can tell you.
Sure. Well, one of our guys, Jeff Perez, just drove the Tacoma, which we'll talk about.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about.
When I first saw a picture of the Land Cruiser, I said, this is what a Lexus LX570 needs to look like.
And then we all saw the LX570.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's I don't know what's going on with Lexus and looks.
It's a very insecty kind of.
I think it works on a few of them, but it doesn't work on the LX570. That thing is just a monstrous.
And this is the almighty double-edged sword of designing this, like, cohesive brand language that every car has to look something sort of like the other car, like the way that Audi has done it. But Audi has sort of a more staid look, so that can crib over to other cars in a much better way.
Audi has managed, Cadillac has managed, Lincoln has not managed.
Well, yeah. But Audi sort of set the stage for that. They were kind of the first to really, I mean, yes, you've got the twin kidney grills, you know, from BMW, but that you could just sort of crib in various, you know, incarnations.
Kind of stretch and morph it, but.
Exactly.
Yeah. Volkswagen's actually surprisingly good at it too.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting within when you look at, you know, brands like up until recently, Hyundai was doing sort of Hyundai and Kia, you know, different car, different class. It might have a completely different look. They're starting to sort of drift towards, you know, cohesive brand language, but theirs are another one that crib well on different levels. It's that hourglass face that just does not crib well onto some vehicles.
Yeah, well, in the LX570, like, I mean, we might as well just talk about it now because we saw it at Monterey. It's just sort of like that's such a tall and sort of awkward
gaping
maw. Yeah, and so, like, you've got this car that's got, it's like a layer cake that's on pillars to begin with because it's got these small tires and these big wheel openings, and then, like, just like layer piled upon layer. It winds up looking awkward.
What was nice about that vehicle for so long that it sort of stood as a vehicle apart in their lineup and sort of just did its own thing for a very long time.
It just was old and they never updated it.
Yeah, just leave it in the corner, let it do its thing. When everyone needs to go get their shoes muddy, they'd go take the LX out. And then they go, oh, I know, we want to take the front of an IS250 and stretch it.
Well, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I like the IS-250. I like the RCF. Yes. I mean, I think they put those, and I like the IS-350, too. Like, they all look good.
The problem is when you take this, you know, front gaping maw, as it were, and stretch it onto a larger vehicle, it's like from Inspector Gadget, a Go Gadget goes from a sports car to a van, and all of a sudden you've got this, like, weird, bizarro world proportions.
Yeah. But, I mean, the driving the LX570 is going to be glorious.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it and I can see they're going right at the Infiniti QX 80, 90, whatever it is at this point.
The QX 80 is just like that's Moby Infiniti.
Yeah.
But I love that thing.
But that has a much better look, and that's taking their corporate design language and cribbing it onto a long vehicle.
I don't know, man. The last time, because I looked at that like this week, and I was like, "Ooh, ouchie!" Like it looks like a whale.
The last time I had it for a press vehicle was last summer. My brother had one recently as a rental vehicle, believe it or not, and it was. I mean, they're great cars. He loved it. He said he liked it better than, you know, a Range Rover or a Tahoe.
Well, it depends on the interior level, but the last QX that I had was opulent, and so I very much enjoyed it.
They know how to do their interiors very well.
They do. All right. Well, and Chris, I know you're rocking the personal Outback.
Yeah, the Outback and the Mini. They're going strong.
They staying strong?
Staying very strong, yeah. I know Brandon was complaining about all the issues on his Mini on the last podcast, and I must have gotten the outlier because I have never had a problem with the damn thing.
So. Did you buy new?
Yeah. It'll be 10 years old on Halloween of this year. Maybe if you get them on Halloween, there's some sort of black magic and it just works. But yeah,
it could be. It could be the German car with the British name on the pagan holiday. Right. Yeah, whatever.
So how about you, Dan? What are you going with this
week? I mean, I've got the press car on the podcast this week. I have just stepped out of a 2016 Ford Escape SE front wheel drive. So this one actually had the small EcoBoost, the 2 liter, which doesn't feel small. I think I actually prefer the smaller EcoBoost to the larger one. It seems to get along just fine, and it doesn't have any sort of peaks or dips. It just, you know, it's a satisfying powertrain. The biggest thing about this one is the new Sync 3, which is what this one was carrying. It was actually a pre-production vehicle. Sync 3 is much better than my Ford Touch.
That sounded like a very reserved.
Yeah, you're not too convincing there.
Damn, it's showing. The reason why I'm a little hesitant is because now the way Sync 3 is designed, it's going to be really great on a larger screen. It's almost like a tablet OS. Mm-hmm. So the more real estate you have, it's got, you know, down at the bottom is sort of the dock of icons, and you can select which function you want. That's all still, you know, improved quite a bit. But on the screen in the Escape, there's a little cramped, so you can.
How big are we talking?
I want to say it's like 7, maybe 8 inches. It's not even 8 inches. It's probably 6 or 7 inches. I you know what? I have the sticker in front of me, so I should be able to. Check. It doesn't say how big it is, but I will say it's not that big. So that you start to like stab at the screen and you miss. You know, you hit the wrong thing, and that's a little frustrating. The functionality is better. The speed of the system is better. You're not hunting because the old My Ford Touch thing was the corners were color coded, and if you didn't have that explained to you, you wouldn't have known.
Right.
You'd be like, where do I find the thing for the thing? It's not quite like that with Sync 3. It's better. It's still funny when they feel the need to like put a little visual graphic of what you've just done in the screen. Like if you adjust the audio volume, it pops up the little audio volume icon and like gives you the number. It's like, I know, I just turned up the radio.
It's loud. It's not loud anymore.
Wow. Right. Like there's no need for that. I have ears.
Are there like tactile navigation buttons on either side so you can rely on, or are you just sort of stabbing blindly at a touchscreen?
There's a couple of little buttony helpers, but it's mostly touchscreen.
See, because that was, if you look at, you know, Volkswagen's touchscreen on the smaller, lower level trims, you've got some buttons like, you know, your navigation buttons, your setting buttons, you know, stuff like that to fall back on. And then other stuff is within, which sort of makes better use of the space. Ford, you know, they did this with, you know, maybe in a different way with the last versions of Sync, where the lower level cars have like the very small Sync screen far, far away that you're controlling with, you know, directional pads, you know, in the center console.
Yeah, this doesn't have that. It's so I also, it depends on which audio system you have, I think. Like some of the cars are going to have that Sony system, which is going to have a little more of like a joysticky thing. So the SE is a little bit more basic. So it had a more basic sort of button setup and that kind of thing. It's much better to use. I will say they've improved it quite a bit, and they're still, they've got a ways to go. And I have a feeling that all of this stuff is going to wind up being an interim step until we get to, you know, the gold standard, which is either some company like Apple or, you know, Google with like an Android function that's more than just like the mirroring. Like that's going to be the low end where you can mirror your phone into the system and it interoperates seamlessly. We're almost there. Right. And then the next level is going to be like everybody's going to stop trying to reinvent the wheel for themselves. And there's going to be sort of one supplier that just wins the day. Yeah. And it's going to be the thing you need to have. There's going to be like one or two suppliers. And like really, we're almost there as well, because there are just a couple of companies that make this stuff. Harman makes a ton of these systems.
Right.
You know, under different brands and for different auto manufacturers.
Well,
and
that's the important thing to point out is that, I mean, even if Apple and Android come out with these great systems and they're universal and they're plug and play and they can mirror and they're good to go, the automakers desperately want to sell you something that's proprietary, that has their sort of sheen on it, even if that means tweaking that Apple or Android system just a little bit. So as this thing moves on, I'm worried to see sort of, you know, any way to, that sort of sidesteps the progress of this move towards this universal infotainment system.
I mean, some of it's going to be the fact that like it just has to, by its very nature, be tweaked slightly depending on which vehicle it's in because of the functions they're driving through it. So every vehicle, it's going to be a node on the CAN bus network. It already is, but the way it actually, you know, talks to the rest of the vehicles is going to be a little different. And
based on what actual hardware you have. Yeah.
Right. But that's really no different than the fact that there's one or two laptop manufacturers for like PC laptops, and they're very much tweaked for whichever OEM is buying them,
right,
and packaged up differently. But honestly, the hardware, at least the last time I looked into it, there's not a whole lot of hardware manufacturers in town. Like that whole thing's going to consolidate. And, you know, I'm hopeful that will make it better, because some of these infotainment systems are just horrible. Sync 3 is not one of the horrible ones. It's actually, it's good. And for the amount of bitching that I did about my Ford Touch when it first came out, and, you know, this is much improved. So Ford did a good job. It's still got its issues, but in terms of like responsiveness and speed and being able to find what you want intuitively, much, much better. So kudos to Ford. And the rest of the Escape, I really like this thing. It's like luxury car quiet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's super quiet, and it feels so solid, and which isn't a huge surprise given that it's based on the Focus. So the Focus is solid as hell too. So there's that, like, you close the door and it's like this solid thunk, and it drives like a million bucks.
Oh, it's got a great ride. I mean, the steering is pretty tight. It's, some people, if an older driver gets it, they might find that it's a little stiff of a ride. But you know, for most people that buy it, it's a great ride. It handles well. You know, it's a car kind of like the Fusion, where there's sort of decent steering response that even if you're sort of into driving, you're like, this thing doesn't stink.
Yeah, it doesn't stink. And so the thing that astounds me is just sort of the way its structure is so solid that it doesn't shudder, doesn't shake. It just soaks up bumps, but it also doesn't float. It's very well tuned, and I'm impressed by that. I got 26 miles to the gallon in it, which is pretty good. That's probably the best I've ever gotten out of an EcoBoost powertrain. The couple of sort of knocks on it are, I think it's overstyled both inside and out, especially inside. There's just so many different pieces of plastic that make up the dashboard, and they're all just like arrayed strangely. And
I was just going to say, I slightly disagree. I actually like the exterior. I kind of like that little out, that bit of, you know, standing outside of kind of the more boring cars. I dig the exterior. The interior, I can definitely see what you mean.
Theater car styling, though.
So the exterior is not quite as bad. It's just, it's busy. Like, there's a lot of lines on the exterior. They resolve pretty well, but the nose has a lot of elements to it. Like, and it's always that thing, right? Like, how do you smooth it off, or do you go for something that's a little bit more flamboyant? You know, at least it looks like a Ford. So kudos for that. But
the thing is, though, I mean, look at the rest of the lineup. Look at the Fusion and the Focus. I mean, they've shown this. I wish that they would take that corporate styling that's shown on the Fusion, the Focus, and crib it over to the Escape. I mean, that would look pretty cool with sort of a large Aston Martin aping maw on the front of it.
Well, the Focus has actually gotten smoothed out, and that looks a lot better than it used to.
Exactly.
They made a very subtle set of changes for the most recent Focuses, and they do look better. So
that wasn't subtle. That was the change I was hoping for. I did not like the busy lower front valence that tried to look like it was functional but really wasn't.
Yeah,
I like what they did with this. It looks great.
Yeah, so I mean, the Escape is headed for its mid-cycle refresh. It'll get there. The interior of the Escape is definitely like there's just too much going on. The dash has too many pieces of plastic. It's just I don't see why they couldn't make it out of like two pieces instead of the five that surround the screen. And like, this is the stuff you're looking at every day. And it just like, it drives so expensive and it looks so cheap. And maybe it's because it was all in black, you know, maybe a lighter color would ease my anxiety about it. I don't know. I found the interior, while very comfortable and super quiet, and you know, it was a great place to spend time, it looks cheap, and that is kind of offensive on a vehicle that easily pushes over $30,000. And then the backseat looks way flimsy. It's got this thin, nasty little padding on the bottom. And, you know, I know that it's an SE, but still, like, that's if the biggest knock I could make is just the interior looks cheap. It's comfortable. It's fine otherwise, but it just, to me, it's like every time you look at that, you're going to be like, I'm paying how much a month for this? And that's going to aggravate you. So,
yeah, but you can light up the cup holders in 13 different colors.
Yeah. Yeah. I always shut that off. Like, why do we need cabins so polluted with light?
I like that.
I shut the screens off as much as I can. I want it dark in there.
It's a nice parlor trick for people that don't see like new cars often.
Yeah. So, the things that people are astounded by in the new cars are hilarious, because you usually find that they're like 5 years behind the curve.
Sure.
When they're like, oh, you can stream your phone through the audio. It's like, yeah, Bluetooth. It's,
well, no, the best relax. Is just try showing or explaining to somebody the Forest Air feature on any Infiniti that has it.
Yeah. Yeah, like the weird sort of puffs of air. Yeah,
it randomizes the fan speed to replicate a forest wind.
Yeah, which otherwise it just means the fan's busted. but when you get the solid features, like, where do you go, right? Like, I mean, try to explain the perfume dispenser or whatever it is in the S-Class.
Well, that's the thing. We've gotten to this like feature saturation where, through the democratization of all these like luxury features, you can get any car now with power everything and leather and all this stuff. And so now the automakers are sort of forced to go, all right, well, now what do we do?
Right.
Now, stuff like massaging seats, I mean,
Oh, that kills people. That just, I like the ones that, like, the active seats, like in the BMWs.
The Mercedes does that too.
Yeah, right. So you leave them on, and you're like, yeah, let's go to lunch. And you bend it into a corner, and it's like, and your passenger's like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah, for those who don't know, it basically inflates the outside side bolster of the seat of the turn you're turning into.
Yeah.
It's a strange feeling.
It's, yeah. But I mean, so the bottom line on the Escape is that it's solid. It's great to drive. It's definitely a contender in the market. The interior looks cheap. Sync 3 is great. So it's a huge upgrade. I mean, I would much prefer Sync 3 over, you know, whatever's in the Honda, like in the CRV.
One question though. Crazy. One question. Does it have that Sony audio system that has the horrible touch capacitive?
No, this one did not. The SE does not. So
that's,
you can get
that's
that.
Still out there.
Yeah. And so is it, here's something weird too. Like, I've noticed on some cars, like some of the Chryslers and the Fords, the satellite radio sounds terrible.
Yes, absolutely. It's and, not the quality, but it's like how easy it takes for it to get knocked out of reception.
Well, there's that. And then there's also, there is the sound quality, which, so it's a codec like MP3. So it's encoded when it's beamed up to the satellite and, you know, bounces off the bird and comes back down, and it's decoded at the receive end. So whatever decoder magic some companies are doing, make it sound great. Bose, every Bose system sounds awesome on satellite radio. Like, it's still obviously a compressed audio stream, like data compressed, sounds very good. Whatever reconstruction filter and whatever they're using,
Dan Roth's
really
home
good.
Studio is completely lined in foil.
It is. It's lead.
Explains a lot.
Yeah, sure does. We're just all little dwarves over here. But yeah, but the Ford, I don't know what chip they're buying from, what whatever. It's just, it doesn't sound good. And Chrysler's the same way. You just hear all these weird, terrible data compression artifacts. And with that, I think we should move on to actually covering some of this week's news. What do you guys want to cover first? Do you want to talk about the Tacoma first, or do you want to talk about Pebble Beach Madness?
Let's talk about Monterey first, I think.
All right. So,
George, is that okay with you?
Sounds good to me.
All right. So this was like the whole, well, I mean, you covered a little bit of it, Chris. Why don't you sort of explain for those of us who have been living under rocks what Monterey and Pebble Beach is?
Sure. I didn't go this year. I stayed here and mostly did most of our auction coverage.
You did coverage from afar, which is probably better.
It depends. Some of the events this year look pretty great. But basically, Monterey Car Week, it kind of goes Wednesday or Thursday to that Sunday. So it's not technically a week, but it's just a ton of really ritzy car events on the Monterey Peninsula over those days. So you've got things like the Tour d'Elegance, which in my opinion is probably the best event there, where all the cars that are actually going to be in the Concours d'Elegance, they go and take a drive, and you can, for free, you just kind of sit by the side of the road and watch them. But, you know, there's stuff at Laguna Seca. There's a ton of different auctions that are going on. And then, obviously, there's the big Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance itself, which happens on Sunday, where the cars park on the golf course, probably the best use for a golf course anyone's ever thought of. And you walk around, you take a look at them, and it's right on the, you can hear, as you're walking by them, if you're there early, you can hear the waves crashing against the beach. It's just a very nice setting for some insanely expensive cars.
To compare it is like if you've ever been to like go out for a week during a Super Bowl, wherever the Super Bowl is, there is stuff going on everywhere at all hours.
Yeah, but this is not the Super Bowl, Chris.
No, but well, for cars, arguably it could be.
No. If it were the Super Bowl crowd, you'd be at like the Indy 500.
I understand,
like,
crowd wise is different rarefied air, but in terms of sort of the nonstop action, I think it would be a good, and you know.
So the impression I get is that the like from the like all the straw hats and nonsense I see, and just like glasses of wine and general air of words I don't want to say.
But there's stuff for the masses too. I mean, there's the Concours de Lemons.
See, yes. That's fantastic.
There's the thing, all the cars that are sort of lined up, you know, downtown in Monterey. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's really it. If there are other events for the masses, somebody please let me know. Like,
there's two things.
Hey, I'll tell you one that was great last year. Go just walk through the parking lot.
That's what I was just going to say.
And it is the greatest car show you'll ever be to ever visit. I saw at least one, maybe two Zagato-bodied Aston Martins just in the parking lot. Not in, like, you know, where the stuff is. Just sitting in the parking lot. I mean, it's amazing.
See, and that's the cool
thing.
The closest
I got to that was the parking lot at Greenwich. Yeah, at Greenwich. And that's a fun one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so, like, you actually get to see these cars being used, you know, where, like, you go into the event and they're, like, sitting on the lawn and maybe they get driven a little bit, you know, around the golf course, but they don't actually get used.
Well, that's what makes the tour that Chris pointed out so great, is that these are the cars, they're all in motion.
Yeah, and that's what they're made for, right? So just, like, to go and sort of, I don't know, like, this strikes me as, like, a polo crowd.
Well, it is and it isn't, because while there's the whole Pebble Beach Concours stuff going on, there's also the Rolex Motorsports reunion going on at Laguna Seca, and that is just racing, and that's a great event. And, like, there was a huge race with Shelby GT350s and Shelby Mustangs in general and stuff like that this year, and that just looked beautiful.
Right, that was for the 50th anniversary of the GT350. Right. Yeah,
and that's a really cool community too. I mean, I try and get out to Lime Rock's Historics Weekend, which is Labor Day weekend every year, and that's 3 days of vintage racing. And a lot of these guys will turn around and have their cars prepped just in time for Lime Rock. I mean, not all of them, a small subset, but it's a lot of the same community. And if you're out there racing a vintage car, you're made of good stock.
So you headed to Lime Rock soon then?
I don't know if I'll be able to make it this year.
You should go.
I hope I can, because the last year before it competes with Indy in Boston.
That's right, Indy in Boston. Well, that's Indy in Boston. I mean, come on. You think that's going to last more than a year?
We'll see. But you know what the cool part is? We'll have, I hope, Tudor. Be the day before. Mm-hmm. That's, I'm all for that.
I mean, I'm gonna try to save next Labor Day just for Indy and Boston. It's so great that happened and the Olympics didn't. So
it's a perfect world for Bostonian car people.
So is this a new phenomenon too that we're seeing? Like, it seems like this year much more has happened with automakers going and introing stuff at Pebble Beach or just ahead of Pebble Beach. Like, we saw BMW, Infiniti. We talked about the LX570, the Lexus, and then McLaren. Like, there was a bunch of actual legit automaker stuff.
I think it's been building. I mean, last year, I know BMW, I think it was at least the North American premiere for the M5 anniversary edition. So we've seen kind of premieres there before, but this year it really did seem to explode with, like, the M4 GTS and the Hyundai Vision G and stuff like that.
And the 3.0 CSL Homage R.
Homage spelled incorrectly.
I know. I've actually freaked out when I looked at it in the gallery. I'm like, wait, did I spell that wrong when I put it in the gallery?
No, they did that, like, with the first Homage, and it's like, why are you guys doing that? Why?
I think the first one was a typo, and then they just decided to go with it.
Yeah, they made up some justification. There was something like that with a Mercedes that was a brake, but they spelled brake incorrectly as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, could be better than the story behind the Mitsubishi Starion, but story for a different day.
What was the story behind the Starion?
I'll tell you in the after hours.
All right.
It's a pretty good story, Dan. You'll have it. Yeah.
In terms of sort of
I just like the Cordia L. You can get Mitsubishi Cordial.
In terms of the build for these things, I mean, I think if there was sort of a compound effect of, if you look at, like, the Concorso d'Eleganza, you know, BMW has been, you know, sort of dropping concept cars at that for a few years.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I think this is almost like trickle down of that sort of effect. Because those cars made headlines, those Zagato-bodied BMWs, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool. It's a different venue, and it's a different kind of thing, right? So you can have, like, those Zagato-bodied BMWs are beautiful.
Stunning. And
to see, like, that's definitely the right crowd to come out swinging with your design. And so we see different stuff at an event like Pebble. So I mean, props for that. And, you know, from the automaker perspective, it gives them the opportunity to show something in the normally sleepy kind of summer months and keep themselves, you know, up in the news. So, you know, that's very tactical.
It's What's interesting, though, is to look at some of the displays, I guess. Like Lamborghini brought down what looked like a display, which would have come right out of its auto show circuit. So very pristine, sharp angles and stuff. And it was very out of place. I mean, very Lamborghini, but very out of place in the setting. Meanwhile, there was like some like Ferrari F40, F50 stand that had like wooden benches and a, you know, little lean-to umbrella lined up, like sort of getting in the whole like summertime lemonade thing going on and really sort of getting a little bit more in touch with sort of being actually outside and not under the bright lights of an auto show. Mm-hmm.
So what was the favorite thing you saw there? I mean, because there was the stuff at Pebble, and there was also auctions and things. So, you know, what was the favorite thing you saw there?
I would have to say I love for like, you know, various Ferrari performance motorsport cars. So that 250 short wheelbase Tour de France that went for $13.2 million, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, Ferrari. Go ahead, Chris.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I totally agree, except I think the Ferrari 250 LM, the mid-engine that went for $17 million, was my favorite.
Okay, all right. Got to one-up me.
I just prefer that shape, but a little bit more. But, that was probably my favorite classic of the show. The display of the three NSXs I thought was kind of neat. That's, you know, probably the only three they've got, but putting that out with the three different colors I thought was neat as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. So, I mean, that's something we could probably talk about it for quite a while. I mean, the car that won Best in Show was the Isotta Fraschini, the Tipo 8A. So that, I mean, pretty great right there. Just super cool to see it.
That was interesting because it was, I mean, there's not a lot that we kind of know about that car. It's not a name that people readily know. Even sort of the car's background. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, clean ownership through four owners, but it's something that we sort of don't know, like a sort of pedigree. So then it becomes like one of those pure concourse cars of its straight up visual appeal. Like, does it knock you off your socks? You know? And so,
well, I think you have to understand that car and the time period to really like get why it's so impressive. Because, okay, 1924, it easily looks like something that's from like 1934.
Well, that's the thing. It is. No, seriously. We put up an interview with the owner. So the chassis is a 1924, but it was rebodied in 1931 and shown at the Geneva Motor Show.
Okay. All right. I remember is a story that the guy, the original owner, wanted to see what a roadster body would look like on a
Yeah, see, I thought it was like started in 24 and wasn't finished till like 31.
Oh, well, okay. So, all right. Right. But somehow there was like this weird time gap. Maybe I'm wrong that it was rebodied, but you're right. The chassis is from one bit and the body is from years later, and they kind of beautifully came together into this thing.
Yeah. Either way, I mean, it's an impressive car, and just sort of seeing that stuff up close, you get the scale of it and all those things. You don't get to see them too much, you know, running and moving around and just, you know, being up close to them. So that's cool. So I'll give him a pass on the funny hats and the sort of apparent, you know, it reminds me of like some of the sailboat people when I was a kid growing up, like,
hey, watch sailboats. Your mouth. I'm
right.
A
that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, there's two classes of sailboat people. At least there's the very douchey and then there's the just sort of like normal people. So they can mix to a certain degree. So, and if we didn't have the elites, we wouldn't be able to buy their cast-offs. So, you know what? Carry on.
The other thing that's great to point out, too, is that, you know, when it comes to wealth and people owning cars, you get to a certain point and you keep the car and you value it and you treasure it and you put it away. Then I think at a certain point you get up to this, like, tax bracket where, you know, they're a little more okay with letting these cars out and letting them roam around. And I think that's why it makes events like this so great, is you're dealing with some people with some pretty serious net worth, and it allows them to be a little more okay with taken the reins off some of these cars, and that's why you get events like the Motorsport Reunion.
At the end of the day, it's a car. It's made to be driven, and it has to be insured. So if you've got something like that, like, yeah, all right, something bad happens to it, it's going to be bad. But, you know, it's pretty bad to just let it sit and rot, too. Like, why are you going to pay to restore it and then just have it sit there? No, go
enjoy it. I don't know if it was Jay Leno or the guy from Chasing Cars, Wayne Carini, said... Yeah. You know, there should always be a couple really good stewards of a car. And outside of that, everybody else should just have fun with it.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right. Let's move on to the next topic. Because we could talk about this for the rest of the night, and I don't think anybody wants to hear that. So we also saw very recently the new Tacoma. And so the Tacoma is one of those vehicles that has been iconic for Toyota for you know, since before it even had a name. And I'm kind of torn on this, so maybe we can have a little tiebreaker. So do you guys think that this is an incremental change, sort of like just a baby step where they tarted up what they already had? Or is this a big deal and will keep Toyota out in front in that sort of small truck class?
I think it's an incremental change, and it'll be very interesting how this stacks up with the Colorado sales-wise. Because I am not 100% sure that Toyota has done enough, not having driven it yet, admittedly.
This is one of those mid-cycle refreshes that I think goes just what it had to do to stretch out the length of its tooth.
Wow, you guys are cynics.
I'm not being cynical. Perhaps I chose words poorly. I'm just a writer.
You are. That is redundant. You are a cynic. Come on now.
All right, actually, good point. Well, Jeff Perez from Bold Ride drove it, and he said that it was really good off road, as which, you know, we would expect. It looks a lot better in person. Like, I already thought it looked like a pretty sharp update, but he said it looked terrific in person. Still kind of a slug in terms of on road driving manners, but any Jeep owner will say fine, whatever.
Yeah.
So the interior was a nice big upgrade. That was a place that was really, you know, kind of needed some additions. The infotainment's going to be there. And sort of his takeaway was, in general, a really healthy evolution that sort of sets it up to be good for years to come.
See, I mean, that seems a lot more positive than what you said.
You know, what's too bad is that we were trying to say the exact same thing.
All right. Because we sent Jeremy out, and Jeremy drove it, and he was of the opinion, too, that it is a solid update. And, you know, most of the stuff that they changed, they changed for the better. I think the biggest takeaway that I have from sort of looking at it is, regardless of what everybody else is doing, Toyota didn't really need to do anything.
Seriously.
They could have just kept selling the old one because outsells everyone else.
Having driven the Colorado, and that was, if you remember the last time I was on this podcast in early or mid-14, that was one of the vehicles that I was most looking forward to driving. And I was really disappointed. I would still totally get one, but I would look at it begrudgingly sometimes. It's a really good-looking truck, but it just doesn't stack up in terms of sort of interior feel, fit and finish. They try to go for sort of a softer aesthetic and combine with sort of that, what you need to be a rugged truck. It just doesn't mesh well. The thing that drives me completely insane about the Colorado is that the seat is manual. It's, what is it? It's, even if it's power
bottom, manual backrest.
Yeah. No, well, A, there's that, which drives me off a flipping wall. But more importantly, when you raise and lower the seat, it's not sort of the cantilevers that raise it evenly. It's
just one
lever. Yeah. So you're basically like lifting yourself, tilting yourself into the steering wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And at 6'3 and big old Kevin Garnett gangly arms, I cannot get a good driving position at all in that car.
You know what you need?
What?
Full-size truck.
Yeah, but I really like, and I, as a first-generation 4Runner owner, I really want to own a mid-size truck.
So, yeah, and you know they're making it a little easier in terms of bringing some of those features down to these midsize trucks. And this is, so my opinion on the Tacoma is that it's a pretty solid upgrade. You know, they brought the 3.5 liter V6 down from the 4.0 that would roar very ferociously, but not actually make any real power. They've consolidated some of the engine and transmission options. It's overall, it's still highly configurable. It's the truck that wins the day because it fits in all of the segments and it can be configured so many different ways. The tell for me is going to be whether or not that interior, which looks really nice, is up to the touch. You know, does it feel nice? Because that's been a consistent issue, especially with the Tacoma, is that it just feels so nasty inside. And you have that weird splay leg seating position that they've had since, you know, the Marty McFly days.
Right. I think one of the things to consider, though, is there's almost like it's almost that aura that Toyota has built for itself, where they can sort of get away with that because it's Toyota. I don't know. That's not an explain away at all. But it's you know, we'll see. You're right.
Yeah, that's such a we're copping out. Chris, help us out here, Chris. What else is there to say about the Tacoma?
You look at it on paper, though, and it's slightly down, at least in V6 wise, it's slightly down on power to the Colorado, slightly down on torque, slightly down in towing. I mean, none of them are precipitous, but I just wonder if someone who is just looking at a spec sheet between two of them before taking a drive isn't going to want to consider the Colorado more.
Yeah, the spec sheet thing actually came up because it's only got drum brakes in the back, which
There's that too.
Right,
yeah.
Toyota's line is like, look, if you need disc brakes on your truck, like that's only help out in towing. If you're towing so much where you need that, you need a bigger truck. We have the Tundra for that, which I mean, it's totally valid and it makes sense. And honestly, off road, I'm not sure that drum brakes are a liability. Because drum brakes will actually work when they're, you know, when they're doused in mud to a certain degree. Like, it depends on sort of what kind of puddle you go through, whatever. But
submerged, maybe not.
Yeah, but they'll work in an area where a disc won't.
Sure.
Sometimes. So there's that. Like, and honestly, it's probably just a cost thing.
So right, because is that something buyers are going to do that often?
Well, I think of all the vehicles on the road, the Tacoma has some actual off-road usage.
Okay, yeah.
Probably not as much as like a Wrangler.
Following, especially up here in New England.
Yeah, I mean, they're around, and to the point where they make you can select the the Pro 4X or whatever.
TRD Pro.
TRD Pro, right?
Which I don't. From the last sort of reports about the pricing leaks, there wasn't a TRD Pro. There was like a TRD Sport and a TRD Off-Road.
Right. So one of them has different lower fascias on the front and rear. So
that, for better approach angles and stuff like that.
Departure angles are different. So like credibility-wise, like they build the thing to be used.
They're one of the folks that still take that segment of stuff seriously, that or even acknowledge it at all, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, even the 4Runner is good off-road,
right,
to the point where it's much better off the road than it is on the
so what I think it comes down to with the Colorado and the Tacoma, and I guess at some point the Frontier, is Chevy took the approach of let's do what works with our big trucks and scale it down in a way, and Toyota, having made small trucks first, knew that this is the truck that sort of operates for somebody. They're not getting it for the contractor who doesn't need the space. They're getting it for the person who has, you know, a bunch of mountain bikes and surfboards and, you know, a bunch of toys that wants to go out and take it out on weekends. And they know what that person wants. And the Tacoma, I think, will eventually, you know, prove to fit that better than the Colorado does.
Yeah, well, they gave us, I forget what exactly it was, but they gave us a list of concerns to a certain degree of what the buyers of this truck want, and towing is way down on the list.
It's
not it's not a small truck to replace a big truck. It is what it is, and it has a very loyal following. And like, resale on these is through the roof.
I mean, all you're towing with this thing are jet skis.
Yeah, and it does that all day long. Fine. Yep. You know, there's the whole issue with the the way the frame is set up, where it's boxed in front and then it's C channel in the rear, and Toyota says it's designed to flex to keep the wheels in contact with the ground and in off-road situations. I can buy that to a certain degree. I don't know whether, again, like the same thing I can buy about the drum brakes. Like, okay, but also, like, I don't know.
Idea for an article. List of all the times that something strange like that has been met by engineers with, well, it's designed to do that.
Right. I'm just going to start using that line. No. It's supposed to be that way. No, the wheel's supposed to fall off. It's a feature.
They're speed holes, Mr. Simpson.
Yeah. I mean, you know what's going to do great. The Tacoma is going to continue to do really well in the marketplace. And I honestly, the exterior looks fantastic. I think they've done a really good job updating it. And, for all of the things that we criticize it for, it continues to sell like the gangbusters, like the hotcakes. So it'll keep doing that. And it's good to have choice in the smaller trucks.
I would love to know if the Ranger was never discontinued, how well would it still be selling?
Oh, here we go with the Ranger.
And the answer, I bet, would be very.
I saw a 2011 Ranger for sale for $16,000, and I wanted to cry.
Oh, geez.
It's just like, it's not that good of a truck. It's not.
Right, but it's just this American small. It was the smallest pickup, and it stayed small, and it never had generation bloat.
Yeah, because they never they gave it one refresh, one like full refresh in 1993, 94, but it was the same frame. Like, it was the same truck. And I mean, it was cool in 94, 95. Was that true?
The best sales year for that truck was the last year that they made it, or is that?
Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah,
it's just.
See, all right, so I won't get into like a whole like gun argument, but with old.
Where are you going?
Yes, where I'm going with this, like the Ranger and like the Wrangler. The fear of what's coming next drives people to pick them up. Like anytime that there's like a, you know. Fear of like gun control laws coming into play, sales go up. When people think the next generation isn't going to be as brawny or as robust, you know, people are just flocking in and going to get them. And that's why
I'm
going to
let you own that simile. It's George Kennedy, bold ride, everybody.
Oh, making, boy.
Gun control parallels.
And what can you put in the back of a Ranger? Gun rack. No.
Yeah. And sure. I mean, I don't disagree that people snapped them up because they knew they were dying, but like, that truck is just not. It's not minted out of solid gold. It's not worth $16,000. It wasn't worth $16,000 new. So just, no, stop.
People love them.
Yeah. And I'm tired of the, like, oh, they just need a new Ranger. Like, clearly they don't, because there's one truck that owns the segment. It's the Tacoma. Everybody else is trying to chip their way back into it. And I honestly don't think General Motors is really going to make a ton of profit, if any, on their trucks.
I was going to say, at the price that they're selling these things at for the trim you actually want and the margins that it takes for the automaker, it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, yes, you look at some of the international versions of these trucks, but the international Ranger looks badass. It has like the interior of an Escape. It looks cool.
Yeah, it's much bigger.
The Hilux looks really cool. Like all these international trucks, you know, chicken tax, man.
Yeah. That may change. I mean, it probably won't, but it may. We've talked about trucks too much. Let's move on.
Is that a thing?
Talking about trucks too much?
Yeah.
Yeah, can be. Especially since, like, I would commute in a truck. So I'm useless in that sense. But we've got some little news things we can quickly breeze through. Chris, you mentioned the NSX and how that was one of the cool things to see. So the NSX is behind schedule, but we actually got a little time to chat with some Acura folks about the blue one that we saw, prototype number 6. So it's behind schedule, but it's coming. It's going to have a Cosworth block. Like, did you pore over these details and get excited like I did?
Kind of, sort of, yes. That's a car that's excited me forever anyway, so it doesn't take much. It's sad that it's getting a slight delay, and the key is there that it is. It's a model year delay, but in actuality, it's only a few months, basically. You know, it's a quarter or whatever, so yeah. it happens.
And they redesigned it, like, once. They designed this car almost twice.
Essentially twice, yeah.
The engine design changed, like, you know, 3 different times. I mean, you're not the least bit cynical about how many times this thing has been sort of pushed off and delayed, and we've seen smoldering ones on the side of the Nürburgring and stuff like that. Like, you know, at Bold Ride, we ran a story this morning. All the cars that came out while we continue to wait for the NSX. You know, it was, you know, the 458, the 488, 5 different McLarens. McLaren essentially came back from the dead and now has a full portfolio in that time. The R8's going to be here. The Huracan's here. You know, all in the time to wait that we're waiting for this car to come out.
That means it's going to be awesome, though, right?
Yeah, maybe it's worth it. Like, all that money, all that work, it's got to go into something. Maybe it's worth it.
I think it's going to be very impressive, and it's going to rekindle the flame for the NSX. It's because it's not like a respin. It's not retro like a Mustang has been retro, right? Like,
it's in no way retro.
Right. It's only sort of pays homage to the earlier NSX and the fact that it pushes the envelope and it brings a lot of new technology to its segment and, you know, does what the original NSX tried to do, sort of change the landscape with this new technology.
Here's sort of just my one interaction, like, where the first time I ever saw a car in person was at Detroit, you know, on the show floor. And first of all, in terms of pushing the envelope, I would just say it's what I would expect an NSX would look like under Acura's design language right now. It really doesn't, it's not entirely dramatic. And considering we'd seen it sort of leaked out for so long, and then that same show, Ford blew us all away with the GT, which is a completely different design with flying buttresses and all these other insane looking things to it, and just completely blew, you know, upstaged the NSX in such a crazy way, at least from my perspective.
No, and right there you do have an argument, and I think that's the one major miscalculation that Acura made, or Honda made, or however you want to term it, is that when you show a car off so early, people start to get bored with it. And I think the ultimate case in point there is the BRZ. How many BRZ concepts did we see before it actually came out?
Camaro, hello?
Yeah, okay, sure. That's another one.
Mustang, the new Mustang. There was quite a drip campaign for that.
I think the Mustang Camaro is the worst offender. That Camaro was waiting so long. We were waiting on that thing.
Oh, I remember seeing so many BRZ concepts, though. But, you know, you see all of these cars, and then when they're finally here, it's like, oh, isn't this already been here? And Unfortunately, especially with all of the hiccups that the NSX program has clearly had since they had to re-engineer the whole powertrain layout, you know, showing it so early kind of is stealing some of that thunder.
It's an awesome story.
The car is going to be pretty cool.
Yeah, it's going to be great. It's a fully American NSX. It's built in Ohio. Yep. The engine is made in Ohio. We did hear it's going to have like a Cosworth block and heads, which is cool. That sort of excites us because Cosworth, like we said in the post, Cosworth is not really known for making bad engines. It's going to be
even
impressive.
If it's like a Cosworth Vega.
I mean, the Cosworth was not the problem with the Cosworth Vega.
Oh, I know.
It was the Vega.
It was a car they designed to stack in a railroad car.
The Bosch D-Jetronic.
Those pictures are awesome, though. Those pictures of the Vega going vertically in the railroad cars. I love those pictures.
So this is
not a great idea.
Well, let's take a complete tangent for a minute. This is General Motors' problem with small cars. They try to change the industry, like, wholesale with their small car program. They finally learned not to do that with, like, the Cavalier. I think the Cavalier was probably the first very successful GM small car. But they had a project that was very far along that they killed because it was too unconventional. It tried to sort of really push the envelope, and that was the Cadet that never saw the light of day. And then they did it again a decade later with the Corvair that really was an engineer's dream. That car,
revolutionary in so many ways.
If you look at that car, you're just astounded by how modern, how forward thinking, like regardless of the safety issues and the fact.
If any commenter says safety issues, throw a set of radials on them. Shut your damn mouth.
No. Radials make them spooky. Either way, like, for the time, that was GM turning the small car, the just basically re-engineering the whole thing and going, you know what, this maybe there's a better way. They don't do that anymore. And then the Vega, again, they tried, like, to the point where it was supposed to have a rotary engine. It was
Supposed to have that weird side draft. Like, was it an L head engine that was going to go into that too? With tappet heads.
Yeah, and they thought that it was going to. They thought the aluminum block was going to be so efficient at throwing off heat that it didn't need a cooling system or didn't need a
weird. I mean, the whole thing with the Vega is that there's this weird confluence of, like, throughout history with GM and then sometimes with Chrysler, it's like it's usually a combination of two weird factors that result in either like these tremendous successes or horrible failures. And with the Vega, it was this confluence of trying to push the envelope in some regards. So we're talking like the Wankel and stuff, and those things ended up being stillborn. But then at the same time, trying to cut the bottom line so much that you're designing a car around the notion of stacking more into a freaking railroad car.
Well, I mean, that was cool, honestly. Like, oh, we're going to ship them different.
You know what? I see that, and all I see is we are worrying about the bottom line so much that we've gone backwards from let's get into a railroad car.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, so really the issue with the Vega was that Chevy's top guy wound up at the top of GM. That was Pete Estes. He wound up running GM, and the Vega was his baby, and there was infighting and stuff. But like, honestly, from
infighting at GM, no.
Yeah. From there, like so everybody bags on the Vega, especially for its aluminum block engine without liners that, you know, it was like, well, who doesn't put liners in an aluminum block engine? How about BMW? They build their aluminum engines and they deposit the iron on the bores with an electrostatic process that was developed initially for the Vega. So, like, it's only taken 40 years.
Right, it's brought a full circle.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's that. Like, it eventually gets there. That's a complete tangent. We should cover a couple of other things, like 100-mile range in the Nissan Leaf, rumored. Would that make you consider a Leaf as, like, a Tesla alternative?
Wasn't that the original? Wasn't that where we were supposed to get in the first place?
I mean, look, don't confuse me with the facts.
At least there's no big 230 mpg banner. Okay, that's all I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, would you rock this thing now that it has more range, or does it matter to you?
The range was never really the problem. I don't really love the way the Leaf looks anyway. And then yeah, an extra, what is that, 83 miles was the previous rating, I think.
Something 80, 83. Like that. Yeah, like if you were 84, I think, if you were really
okay.
Lucky.
Okay.
I think so, I got about 60 out of it.
That's a good bit extra. That's useful. I still don't think it's for me, but I'm not anti-EV. I'm just not a big Leaf fan.
You're just anti-Leaf. I get it. It kind of looks happy. The one that we have in the post, it has a little smile on its face. It looks like the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man.
That's a good description. Yes.
I'm down with it. I like the Leaf. I've always liked the Leaf. I was terrified driving it on the highway that I was going to run out of range. So more range with
it. Oh, you had range anxiety? Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I was only going about 20 miles, 25 miles. And I was like, I'm not going to make it home. I'm going to plug it in. And that's still the thing. Like, it's not getting to your destination. It's the return trip. Mm-hmm. With the EVs, like, yeah, okay, so it's got 120 or 110 miles of range, according to this dealer in Indianapolis, which is, you know, talking. They've said something. Nissan hasn't commented officially, but if it comes true, it seems logical because it's like a 25% upgrade, and the Leaf has been rumored to be getting a larger battery anyway. So, mm-hmm. It's like the things seem to align, and it's not that far out of bounds. But it's still one of those, like, yeah, I can get to where I'm going, but I'm going to need to charge it up to get home. If I can't charge it up to get home, I'm going to have a problem. And, you know, because it's not, you're not guaranteed 84 miles or 110 miles. It's like more or less, depending on.
Well, it's the EPA estimated range.
Right.
They're clear that, you know, it's not a hard and fast thing.
Yeah.
I think that's where, you know, Tesla comes into play, A, because it's got a longer range, but also that they do a really good job of matching their infrastructure to the navigation in your system and really planning out how you're getting back and, you know, are you charged to get back and sort of, I don't know, sort of where Nissan is at with that.
Would you like me to call a flatbed for you? it'll get there. It'll get there. And I mean, I think that, the fact that you can buy a used Leaf right now is awesome because they're cheap.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we'll never get, because of potholes, we'll never get to the place where, you know, the UK is testing out those wireless charging roads. That's gonna give us all cancer.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's gonna make everyone sterile, which might be all right. it's good. You know, keep pushing the envelope until we get some revolutionary battery technology from the aliens. Like, this is what we've got. We're gonna make incremental gains, and then there'll be a breakthrough, and we'll all just be astounded at how much better it is than it ever used to be. That breakthrough in the past was something like gasoline. So still more energy in 2 gallons of gas than there is in the whole Leaf. We'll get there. I'm positive.
I think you're absolutely right.
The one last thing, and Chris, you wrote this post, so I'm hoping that you're super psyched about it, because I'm kind of not. There's okay. A new Bugatti that they're teasing. The Chiron? Oh,
yeah. The Chiron, yeah.
Yeah. Does that excite you, or are you just kind of like, maybe?
I want to look at it. Like, it's you know, it's a car that's made of benchmarks, essentially. You know, it's I'm sure it's going to be the most powerful, fastest thing in the world. I kind of think the current Veyron kind of looks like a bar of soap.
That's being generous.
To the soap or the Veyron?
To the Veyron. To the
okay. Veyron. yeah, so I don't know. I can't wait to see how much power it makes and how fast it goes, but I'm not super excited about it.
I think what's great about seeing what comes out with the new Bugatti is that this was, like you said, it's a car of benchmarks. This was a car that the sole purpose was to throw an entire company's worth of engineering into to make it the best at everything. And it was, you know, the McLaren F1 will always, you know, be the McLaren F1, but this car was the first, let's kill it with technology and just go, you know, BS out. And it's going to be interesting. And all these other cars came along in the meantime. You know, the whole marketplace of LaFerraris and McLaren P1s and Porsche 918s, the game of what, you know, necessitates a hypercar now with the need for, you know, hybrid drivetrains means that you really want to see what Bugatti comes up with to try and one up not only itself, but all the other players that have tried to dethrone it in the meantime.
Well, I mean, who's going to be the crazy king at the top now? Piëch is gone. So he was the driving force behind the Veyron.
It's so. His baby. Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe enough momentum is behind it now that it just is on its set path.
I hope that they make a 350-mile-an-hour turbine-powered, nuclear car.
Runs on dark matter.
Right, because they say imagine the possible, right? So
the impossible.
Imagine the impossible. So there we go. I think I've effectively imagined the impossible. But if they have like a small nuclear reactor, they could power electric motors for like a decade.
Sure.
And you know, if you make the nuclear reactor big enough, you're not going to have a problem making motors that accelerate to like 100 miles an hour in a second.
1.21 gigawatts.
Yeah, I believe it would be gigawatts or gigawatts.
You're not getting that reference, are you?
I'm getting the reference. I'm being a smartass.
Okay, all right. It was one of those two things.
yes. What is the reference fluxivity of the flux capacitor? How many nanowebs per meter? All right. We're going to do questions now because That's
fun. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So what is the, what would you say is the most dangerous car you've personally driven? Be it to your personal safety, to your finances, or relationship, or some other nature. Wow, that's a sort of broad definition of dangerous. But you know, Chris, what's the most dangerous thing you've ever driven?
Okay, off the top of my head, a buddy of mine had a '93 Celica, and he and I decided during a northeastern Ohio heavy winter blizzard to take it out and basically do handbrake turns through the snow.
Because awesome.
Yeah. Hey, we had seen the videos of the rally version from the early 90s doing it. So, of course, like his Celica GT could do it. I mean, come on. And it, we kind of ended up in a ditch and ended up basically pulling it out and getting it out ourselves. So that was probably the most dangerous car I've ever driven at that time, being egged on by a friend to get the tail out in a Celica.
Friends are dangerous.
Yeah, it was fun though.
Yeah. George, I know it's your XJ.
No, absolutely not. That thing goes too slow for it to be dangerous.
Come on, you're going to get tetanus from that.
Yes, yes. Dangerous to others, absolutely, because I have all my shots. no, I would say, all right, so a couple years ago, a couple summers ago, I got to drive the Factory 5 Shelby Cobra.
I was there.
It was the one that belonged to the head of Factory 5. And I go to hop in, and I was, you know, giddy to grab the keys. And I go, you know, hey, anything I should know before I hop in? Thinking he would say, you know, what's, you know, where should I be shifting at and stuff like that. Watch out for a second or something like that. He goes, yeah, if you don't respect it, it'll kill you.
Okay. That's awesome.
But that wasn't the most dangerous one, though. A couple weeks later, I went to go do a follow-up story. And I got to drive like the rest of the portfolio of like, you know, all the guys that are like their head drivetrain techs and the head of PR. They all drive like crazy Factory 5 Cobras and Daytona coupes that they built themselves. Well, one of them had a Coyote V8 in it, Coyote 5-liter. That thing was just so freaking unruly and just wanted to dance all over the place. That was definitely, and we were sort of driving in a caravan, driving pretty tame, but there were moments, as a matter of fact, when we switched cars and the guy that built it got it back. It was down in Wareham, Mass, and we were sort of going across an intersection, and he gunned it sort of in a left hand onto a side street. There was a little patch of dirt. He spun out right in the middle of the intersection and then sort of started it and took off again. But you know,
it's a good thing it wasn't you in his car doing that.
Yep, that's why I was going slow.
Yeah. That's, I think, probably the most dangerous thing I ever drove was my 240 wagon when I had not torqued down the lug nuts properly. Oh. I drove a good 100 miles with the wheel going clunk, 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 clunk. Yeah.
What could that be?
Right. I was like, I don't know. Is that the bearings or what? Yeah. It was, could have been bad. I wound up replacing wheel studs. You know, it was a pretty good learning experience. But you know, and I haven't really had too many other dangerous cars. I mean, the Viper was one of those cars. It's just like, if you do not respect this car, it will murder you. So, you know, there's that. But the most actually dangerous thing was my 240. Like it. It was just, it was a car that was hacked together by, I think I was 19. So it was a car hacked together by a teenager. It nearly caught on fire a couple of times. Yeah. But it was fun. I liked it.
I mean, I'm sure there was a couple other, you know, experiences I've had, but I'm just like blocking it out of my mind right now.
Yeah.
Repressed memories.
Yeah. If that's not dangerous enough for folks, like, we'll try harder.
Yeah.
You want to spend somebody's money? That's always a good time.
Yes.
All right. 30 to 35,000. They've just had their first child and they would like to think of themselves as the active outdoorsy types. They've got a medium sized dog, so they need a hatchback. They live in Pittsburgh, so they are sad. They need all-wheel drive. Let's see. Their list has been narrowed down to a Forester XT, Turbo Forester. Good job. Mazda CX-5. Please wax poetically as to which will keep us happy or guide us to a different choice we missed. Honestly, with a dog and a kid and four seasons, like, Forester XT is hard to argue against, as much as I like the CX-5.
I love the CX-5, but the Forester just seems to have a little bit more usable space, just due to the sort of the... Well, the CX-5 is sort of an upright body, too. You know, we're going to end up in saying, oh, you can't go wrong with either. But, the Forester XT, you know, the dog is a pretty natural pairing.
Yeah, well, so... Yes. I just honestly, I think the visibility is better out of the Forester. It's actually a little roomier. It's kind of a downer that you can't get it with the manual in the turbo. But the CX-5, you can't get with the manual with all-wheel drive with a large engine either. So you're sort of, the CX-5 is going to handle better. But at the end of the day, I think the XT, the Forester XT is your pick.
You know what? I've got to admit, I was looking at Forester XTs online today. So, yeah, we're basically the Greek chorus on this one. Forester XT, same here.
All right.
One that more. Was easy. Yeah. That was the easiest one of these I've ever done.
We're gonna get caned for that one. Why didn't we recommend something weird? You know what? Get yourself an Outlander Sport.
Oh, I thought you were weird. I'd say used XC90.
Used Subaru Baja.
The used XC90 is just drain my wallet. especially the V8. They have like cam.
No, Forester XT is the right choice.
Get the Forester XT.
I meant to bring this up to – so it's episode 444.
That's right.
It's a international 444 V8 for like industrial use.
Oh, really?
Yep. And the Boss 302 makes 444 horsepower.
Yeah, the International 444. So that was one of those all cast iron engines from back in the day that weighed 1,300 pounds.
It was called IDI.
Indirect injection.
Yeah.
Well, but that's what all diesels were. They were indirect. They had the pre-chamber, and the pre-chamber would start the combustion, and then it would propagate.
It's just funny after hearing years of PR
of DI.
Yeah, exactly. It just sounds like someone's been having a laugh at your expense.
What you really want is one of the old GM two-stroke diesels, because nothing sounds like those. Like a nice 671.
I'm down.
Yeah. You can always tell the boats, like tugboats, had them a lot, and they just have that growl. All right. So with Cadillac announcing diesels in 5 years, will diesels remain nice? Let's point it out. With Cadillac announcing diesels in 5 years, which I don't think is going to happen, will diesels remain a luxury car and CUV thing for like cars that are more than 4,000 pounds, or do you think they're going to sort of propagate? I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't think that Cadillac diesels are going to really happen.
Well, I mean, look, it depends on how expensive it is to option up to that engine. And, you know, if it's another – depends on the automaker. You're looking at, like, what, an extra, like, couple grand for the diesel?
It's probably going to be, like, $3,500
or $4,000. Yeah, so it has to be packaged on a car that you already plan on spending a lot of money on. If you threw that onto, like, a lower volume car, you're looking to spend – you know, $23,000, $24,000, $25,000 on a family sedan, and all of a sudden you get this $4,500 option. It's just not going to add up to, okay, I'm walking into a dealer and I'm ready to spend $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. That can sort of more easily mesh into the option build.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know. Maybe you guys feel differently, but I feel like in the sort of luxury car arena, the diesel leader is Mercedes with the E-Class, and everything else just takes a complete backseat, even BMW.
But BMW is still there, you know, and they're still playing, you know.
I'm not sure.
Audi in there with the TDIs. I mean, that's a more recent addition, but...
That's true.
I mean, Audi and VW, too. I mean, VW is a good example of where, I mean... I'd like to see sort of the percentage breakdowns of how many people are opting for a TDI, Passat wagon Jetta Golf wagon.
But the TDI makes a compelling case for itself. That's true. So the, but those three sort of European luxury brands.
I was going to say, and Volkswagen Audi benefits from the fact that that's a popular build, you know, in other markets. So there's not this like, you know, there's not money being thrown at trying to develop it for that setup.
But maybe because Cadillac wants to go global, maybe that's actually their move.
Right. Well, they got to get people to buy them, buy the Cadillacs in Europe before they, you know, and diesel would be a good way to entice them to do that. So there's a potential, you know, dovetail there.
Yeah. Time will tell.
Time will tell.
All right. I think we're done. So that's podcast 444, indirect injection and all. So Chris Bruce and George Kennedy from Polaroid, thank you very much for filling some time with me on the podcast.
Anytime.
Thank you, Dan.
And we'll see everybody next week. You can subscribe to the Autoblog Podcast in iTunes. Send us an email at podcast@autoblog.com or find us on Twitter @AutoblogPodcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.